grisly daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. So had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? So here we go. He was looking down his nose at the imbeciles going up to the building and killing themselves. And what's he thinking now? He's going to kill himself because there's just, it's death by Dorito just ain't working. You know, it's just not working, you know. And he has nowhere else to turn. He's now tried dieting. He has tried hunkering down on his unaided willpower. He has tried all these various methods of not drinking, and nothing seems to be working.
He tried viciously
to open the window, but it was to no avail.
So he kicked it open
or threw the rocks through it. Okay. Back on track. Sorry about that. Okay. See, you're the monitor now. Okay, but somebody needs to help me here because...
No, not now.
What now?
No, not now.
Yes, thanks. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that, so two bottles and oblivion. So he's drinking now for oblivion. He can't look at his reality anymore. He can't bear to see what he's seeing around him. He can't bear to see what he's doing to Lois. He can't bear to see what he's doing to himself. He can't bear to see the dead end that his life has become. And he is drinking now for total oblivion. And he's getting physically sicker. And he's getting mentally sicker. And the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. When I look back on some of the things I told you about last night, some of the contact dermatitis situations that I had in my life, some of the orthopedic situations that I had in my life as the result of being knock-kneed and 600-700 pounds. I have a false knee and 2 false hips. I need the other knee done right away, if I can get the dog taken care of and get some things squared away. I have arthritis in the back, which happens to normal people, but the knees and the hips and the back and all the devastation of my life, you cannot carry that kind of weight on a human skeleton for as long as I did it without there being some permanent damage to my life. I have atrial fibrillation of the heart because of the massive weight gain and the massive weight loss. Your heart beats boom, 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 boom. My heart goes bum, 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 because that left ventricle on the top is just bum, 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 and I have to take Pradaxa every day, which is a blood thinner, and different things to regulate my blood pressure. But you know what? I'm still alive. What a miracle. I'm still alive. Some of you are still alive despite your best efforts to kill yourself. Maybe you were not thinking about suicide, but you were practicing that death by Dorito. You were practicing that insane eating to the point where it's a miracle that you could get out of a chair. It's a miracle that your heart, it's a miracle that you're still here. The shame and the humiliation, the pain, the loneliness. Oh, the loneliness. The main ingredient was the loneliness that came in as the result of being amputated from life through the food. And yet, here you are. And for every person that I see this morning, there are 10,000 times 10,000 that could only wish that they had the courage to come here like you. If we told them about this, they would say, I will come. But when faced with the actual opportunity, they will not. They will not. For reasons which we don't understand, your body, your mind, and your soul have endured up to now the onslaught of an illness that you didn't choose, you didn't cause, you can't control, and you can't cure. Even if you had zigged when you zagged, you still would have this illness. If your mother and father had zigged when they zagged, you'd still have this illness. It wouldn't matter. We'll get into that a little later today. Okay, you gotta shut me up. I told you that. Okay. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. He's still thinking about killing himself. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking and I was 40 pounds underweight. And maybe you read that and you say, well, he was 40 pounds underweight. I can't relate to that. Is being 40 pounds or 150 pounds overweight any less or more unhealthy than him being 40 pounds underweight? I think not. I think not. He has alcoholic gastritis at this point. He has all kinds of things going on. He can't eat. I'm eating too much. He's not eating at all. It's opposite ends of the same coin, all caused by the illness. I am living in an unnatural, unchosen state. My brother-in-law is a physician. That would be Leonard Strong. That would be the his brother-in-law through Lois. And through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. That would be the town's hospital. Now, we are now going to start to see the constellation of God's mighty hand in this entire scenario. And it is now beginning to play out. It is now going to be some miracle happening after some miracle. And it's going to be just incredible because of all the places that they could have put him, they put him in the towns. Of all the doctors that he could have gotten in the town, he gets Dr. Silkworth. And Silkworth is now going to tell Bill the nature of what he believes this illness to be. Is Bill Wilson the first person that Dr. Silkworth imparted this knowledge on? Probably not. But what do we know with great surety? Bill Wilson is eventually, not right away, he is eventually going to be the very first human being in the history of planet Earth that is going to get an information source about the illness. And on the next page, he's going to get an information source about the recovery, and he is going to take that information that is given him by God over here, given him by God over here, he's going to put it together, and he's going to move it forward so that we could be here this morning. Let's see where the process starts. Let's be grateful for this process, because is it odd or is it God that of all the places he could have been put, of all the doctors there on staff that he could have gotten, we're going to see the hand of God. We're going to see the munificent hand of God reaching out to us who were yet unborn at that time so that he could save our lives through these human beings. Let's see where he goes from there. Best of all, under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a drug somewhat like Valium used today, but it fooled the body into thinking that it had alcohol in it, and it kind of calmed these guys down. The hydrotherapy was a totally useless thing. What they would do is they would put some of these guys in a place where you might have seen that, like on Superman, they'd have a bathtub and they'd zip the guys in, or they would put showers with hot and cold runs, made a clean drunk out of these guys, but it didn't do anything to cure their alcoholism. It cleaned them up, made a clean drunk out of them. That'd be about it. Okay, best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained, though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily, the allergy, and mentally, the mental twist. Now he's got some of the pie. He's got the information on the nature of the illness. And he would think, quite naturally, what I would think, now that I know, I'm going to be okay. Now that I understand that I shouldn't, I was told this morning that if I saw a moose, not to go up and try to pet it because it could stomp on me. Well, I don't know. The only moose I know was on Captain Kangaroo, right, Mr. Moose? That was about the only one I had any real exposure to or in the zoo. too young for Captain Kangaroo? Who's too
no.
Okay. All right. There was Captain, there was Bunny Rabbit, and there was Mr. Moose and Mr. Green Jeans,
yep.
Right? Okay, see, I told you, you've got to tell me to shut up here, especially in the morning when I got coffee here. Okay. Right? And the young people are going, what the hell is he, right? What?
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Right, thank you. Where did Bullwinkle go to college? What's the matter you?
With Peabody.
Mr. Peabody was beautiful. Don't ever play Trivial Pursuit with fat kids. Remember. Don't. Don't do it. Because you guys were out playing grab rear ends and all that, but we were home watching television, so don't do it. Don't do it. You know, just a little piece of advice. Don't play Trivial Pursuit with the fat kids. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, self-knowledge, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. The goose hung high means things went very well. A goose was a symbol of wealth. If you ever see like Christmas Carol and all that, well, goose hung high means things are good. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. This is Bill's second hospitalization. He is replaced under the care of Dr. William Silkworth, and now Silkworth has seen Bill come and go and come and go. This is the second time, and he is now telling Lois what he has told other wives, that Bill is a hopeless alcoholic, that there is nothing that can be done for him. He is going to die of his alcoholism, and you can either know a wet brain is really a dry brain. It's really wet brain is a misnomenclature. What the alcohol does is suck the moisture out of the brain cells, the liver cells, and the brain cannot replenish itself like that. So these guys with wet brain, which is really dry brain, the unfortunate thing is, Alzheimer's at least has the mercy to kill you. It has the kindness to kill you. A dry brain, wet brain kind of thing, these guys can, they have to change their diaper and feed them and change their diaper and feed them and prop them up, and they don't recognize their family. These guys can live like that for decades, and it's really a very pathetic existence. And these guys with wet brain are housed very much like plants in a greenhouse.
I just want to say women, too. I worked in a state hospital in Minnesota in the early 70s, and we had the sister of a governor who herself had been very capable, worked as a secretary, high-level secretary, which was about the only route for a woman at that time, and she was institutionalized with wet brain, and wow, what a sight.
It's one of the most pathetic conditions that a human being can go through. And one of the things that makes it most pathetic is it won't kill you. It doesn't at least have the decency to kill you. And so they have to actually wait for something else to kill you. And it's really sad. Okay. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. Death by Dorito. He wants to end it all. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched all around me in all directions. Excuse me. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. No better description of step one that I've ever seen written. Food was my master. Food was the boss. And it used fear and anger, selfishness and self-seeking as its walking bosses to make sure I told the line, and dishonesty to make sure that I told the line. But the main object of my life was to serve my master, food. I did what it told me to do. I did it according to food's terms, and nothing came between me and my fix of food. Nothing. No shame, no nothing, no anything. Okay, trembling. I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink, and on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. You do not have to wait for page 83 for promises. Here are more. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. Now, we're going to break away from the book for just a minute here, and we're going to talk about some things that are happening that are not known to Bill. There are some things that are happening that are the handiwork of this of God. And God is bringing these constellations of his power together. And he is forming what will be known as our program of recovery in things that are not known to Bill right now. Let's go back to a man named Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard is a very successful business person. His family owns a company called Burlington Mills. If you've ever walked on carpeting, you've probably walked on Burlington carpeting. They are also owners, not the owners, but an owner of a company called Allied Chemicals. And Allied Chemicals is still around today, as is Burlington. And the Hazards of Rhode Island are very, very wealthy people. And they have a son named Roland who is a drunk. And Roland is embarrassing his father, and Roland is getting drunk, and they give Roland tremendous amounts of money to stay away from the office. Do not come here. You're embarrassing the daylights out of our family. Go away. At one time, Roland has himself put on a Caribbean island, and they would bring him supplies so he couldn't get drunk. And as soon as he gets off the island, guess what? Roland's drunk. And Roland wants to give his mother the gift of seeing him sober just one time before he dies. And in the 30s, this would be about 1933-32, he goes and he seeks out the services of the most preeminent psychiatrist in the infant field of psychiatry, and that man's name was Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud was not taking any patients, and so Roland sought out the number two psychiatrist in the world, and his name was Dr. Adler, and Adler wasn't taking any new patients either. The third most preeminent psychiatrist in the world during the early 1930s was a man in Sweden named Dr. Carl Jung. And for 1 year, Dr. Jung treated Roland Hazard, and he psychoanalyzed Roland. And Roland was back at the shipyard after being treated by Dr. Jung for 1 year. He goes back to the shipyard. He's awaiting the ocean liner to take him back across the ocean so he can go home and show his mother that he is sober. He goes into the bar near the shipyard, and he is drunk within a very short period of time. He goes back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung could have told Roland you have a Valium deficiency, we're going to up your meds and you can stay here and I'll psychoanalyze you more. He was too honest of a man for that. And Dr. Jung told Roland that you have been misdiagnosed by me. You are not a depressive. You are not all these various things. You are a hopeless drunk, and there is no way I can help you. You are going to die in your alcohol. Roland begged Dr. Jung for something of an answer. He didn't want to die. He wanted to show his mother that he could be sober. Now, why is it important that Roland got to Jung rather than Adler and Freud? Freud and Adler believed that all answers lie within the mind, that all solutions lie within the mind, and there was nothing in Roland that was going to cure him. A broken brain cannot fix a broken brain. No matter how much you psychoanalyze it, no matter how much you give it therapy, no matter how much you do, a broken brain cannot fix a broken brain. But God, in his infinite wisdom and in his enthusiasm, what is enthusiasm? En theos from God. En theos from God, enthusiasm. He is enthusiastic about starting this new Alcoholics Anonymous movement, and he directs Roland. Is it God or is it God? I believe it's God. He directs Roland over to Jung, who tells him of the spiritual experience. Not awakening, but experience. That here and there, there have been people who have been altered and changed and rearranged by a spiritual experience. Roland asks Jung, how do I bring this upon me? And Dr. Jung says, most of these spiritual experiences have been the products of just random phenomenon, that there is no real way of bringing this about. But Roland decides, now he's got something. He's got something he can cling to. He's got something that Dr. Jung gave him in the way of an answer. And it may not be much, but it's all he has. So he goes back to New York. He stays sober. See, I get excited about this stuff. But he goes back to New York. I'd get more excited if we could open that window. Oh, I'd be even more excited. Okay. He goes back to New York, and he has something here of an answer. And he's got this answer, but he's really not a church person. So he goes to the Cavalry Mission in New York City, where he meets a guy by the name of Sam Shoemaker. And Sam Shoemaker is an Episcopal minister at the Cavalry, and they are practicing the Oxford Group movement tenets. The Oxford Groupers were founded by Frank Buckman. Frank Buckman and Sam Shoemaker were not concerned with a solution for alcoholism at all, even though Sam Shoemaker later would become one of Bill's closest spiritual mentors. They were concerned with reinvigorating Christianity, and they were practicing first century Christianity to the best of their ability. Buckman believed that Christians had lost their enthusiasm. There's that word again. That they had lost their zeal. That early Christians were willing to go and be eaten by lions and mooses and bears and all this other stuff to prove their faith to God. And that the Christians today had become very, very lackadaisical. That Christianity was dying. And they wanted to infuse it. And on a mission to China, Frank Buckman observed people who were not just talking about their faith, they were living their faith through service and self-sacrifice to other human beings. And he gave this information to Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard is now in the Oxford Group movement, which coincidentally, is it, hey, there you go, is it odd or is it God? Coincidentally, we're getting the window open, okay. And Roland is staying sober. Roland is not thinking about drinking. He meets a friend by the name of Shep Cornell. He meets a friend. Yay! He meets another friend by the name of Zebra Graves Jr. And Zebra Graves and Roland Hazard are good friends, and they're working the Oxford Group tenants. And Zebra Graves, thank you. Zebra Graves and Roland are not drinking. Roland goes home, he visits his parents, he's sober, he's working in the Oxford Group movement, he's enthusiastic, he knows nothing of the problem of alcoholism, but he's not drinking. And him and Zebra, they're doing a lot of testimonial, you know, carrying the message of the Oxford Group to other people. Does that sound familiar? Okay. So Zebra Graves Jr. and Roland Hazard decide, hey, you know what, the Hazards, they told me, Zebra, that if we want to take a vacation, my parents will pay. So Zebra Graves Jr. and Roland Hazard take a vacation together. Let's pick this up in a minute, but let's find out what else is going on, unbeknownst to Bill at this time. One of Bill's drinking buddies from his time as a drinker in East Dorset is another guy by the name of Edwin Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby and Bill did a lot of drinking together. And you know, you all have your binge buddies. Some of you marry your binge buddies, but some of you have binge buddies. And you have girlfriends or boyfriends or somebody that you know you can eat the house with them and that it's okay, that they're not going to bother you because they're eating the same way too. Well, Ebby Thatcher and Bill were binge buddies. They did lots of drinking together, and they were very comfortable being drunk with one another because they had done it so many times. Now, Ebby's father was the mayor of Albany, New York. His brother was later to become the mayor of Albany, New York, and if you go to Albany, New York today, there's a big Thatcher Park in honor of his family. But Ebby Thatcher is embarrassing his father, too, because the mayoral elections are coming up and he wants his drunk son out. Get out of Albany. Go to East Dorset, Vermont, where our summer home is, and start getting it ready, because after the election, we're coming to the summer home, so I want you to get the place ready. Ebby goes to East Dorset to get the summer home of the Thatchers all ready for summer. And just to show you the kind of prominence that Ebby comes from, his father was not only the mayor of Albany, New York, he was a very wealthy guy. One of his golf buddies was Robert Lincoln, who was the son of Abraham Lincoln. And this is the kind of crowd that they ran with. But anyway, that aside, Ebby is painting the wall of the summer house. And some pigeons land on the wall, so he does what most normal people do when they're drunk. He gets his shotgun out and starts blasting away at the wall. Well, the neighbors don't like that. They call the police. Ebby is arrested for firing his gun within city limits, brought before the judge and put on probation. Not much longer after that, he drives drunk right into somebody's house, and rather than show any type of contrition, he says to the woman, "Hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee?" So he is now brought before the judge, and he is about to be sentenced on drunken disorderly, and he is about to be remanded to the Vermont State Insane Asylum for treatment of alcoholism. Stop action in your mind. Remember Roland and Zebra Graves Jr.? Remember they were going on a vacation. If they go on their vacation the week after, I'm dead. If they go on the vacation the week before, I'm dead. But Roland and Zebra Graves Jr. decide to go on vacation to see the family of Zebra Graves Jr. in East Dorset, Vermont, and they hear about Roland Hazard going before the judge, and the judge's name is Zebra Graves Sr. Is it odd? Or is it God? Roland is brought before Zebra's father. Zebra has looked at the miraculous transition in his son and in his friend Roland. And Roland and Zebra, even if they're on vacation, still must give testimony and still must serve others. and they ask the judge to give them custody of Abby in September of 1934 to them, or excuse me, August, yeah, to September, October, November, yeah, in 1934, and Judge Graves remands Abby to their custody, and he is told to do what they tell him to do, or he will serve sentence. Abby will come back to Vermont, and he will be in the Vermont State Insane Asylum. Roland, excuse me, Abby doesn't want to be doing this. Like me, he ate, you know, I ate my way to the meetings. He didn't drink his way to the meetings, but he didn't want to be doing this, but he'd rather go with these guys than go to the insane asylum. He had been in some of these laughing academies before. He didn't want to go back. He wanted no part of that. Nobody wants to be under lock and key, so he goes with them, and they've got him, and he's in the Oxford group, and he is sober. Now they tap Abby on the shoulder and they say, Abby, it's time for you to give testimony. And he says, well, how? I don't want to give testimony. And they said, okay, well, we can always ship you back to the Vermont State Insane Asylum. And he says, you know, I think I'll give some testimony. In other words, he was supposed to go tell someone else what God had done for him. I know in Judaism, and I bet I'm not the only person here that follows a religion where it's, here's what God did for us, now go tell others. That's ancient. Anybody here have a religion that doesn't cover something like that? Here's what God did for us, go tell your children, go tell others? I bet not. So, Abby decides, who in New York am I going to give testimony to where I'm not going to embarrass the crap out of myself? And he comes up with the only name he knows, and the only one that he's comfortable enough with to do this with is Bill Wilson.